Recording started.
Hello and welcome to the July 2012 edition of the Sands and its Storm Centers Strong Monthly Threat Update. My name is Johannes Ulrich, and I'm today actually here recording from a Sands fire in Washington, D.C., which is why we had to move this particular edition off the webcast around. We usually do them on Wednesdays, but Wednesday and Thursday was taken up by Sands fire events this week. So this is why we are a little bit late on this. Now, as far as our schedule goes, we have our regular outline, but before we get started, I do want to just point your attention to an event that just came up sort of as I got ready for this webcast, so I don't have a lot of detail yet. We did see a pretty significant increase in UDP packets to port 2427. That port is used by voice over IP capable embedded devices like the XWorks, for example, appears to be somewhat the target here. We are not exactly sure yet what they're trying to accomplish. We got some reports that it may be crashing the device, these scans, so it could be kind of a widespread denial of service attempt. The origin of these packets appear to be VXWorks or other embedded devices themselves, so it may also be some kind of worm spreading on this port. Again, this port is listening if you are running, for example, a DSL modem or something like that that uses VXWorks as its operating system and also supplies voice over IP services, which, of course, a lot of ISPs are now doing if they're also offering voice over IP as part of their package. You should see a diary about this shortly. Actually, Rob, our handler, they may already be working on one, but like I said, we are still trying to put together all the details. Just if you are having DSL modems and such crashing unexpectedly, let us know, and it may be related to these scans. So let's go back to our regular scheduled program. Again, my name is Johannes Ulrich. I'm working for the Sands Technology Institute. And our sponsor for the webcast is, as usual, Core Security. So thanks, Core, for sponsoring the webcast and making it possible. We do record an archive, which in particular, if you missed that we moved the webcast, is probably important for you. We also offer it as a podcast audio only. And this month, I'll actually try to make it sort of as an audio and video podcast available as well. So that'll be a little trial balloon to see if that works for people who like to listen to this offline. Our normal webcast archive, if you go to sands.org/webcasts, there is an archive link on that page that leads to old webcasts, but you can only watch them live via the same interface that you're using now. So our outline, I will start out as usual with Microsoft patches, and then I will talk about manipulating packet captures. I was planning to talk a little bit about hashing passwords, but that will be without slides, just a couple of comments, because again, we had more passwords being leaked, so that's certainly still a hot topic, so I want to make a small comment about that. So what about our Microsoft patch Tuesday this week? It was what I would call an average patch Tuesday. We had 9 bulletins. I think it was a total of 16 different vulnerabilities being patched. 3 of the bulletins were rated critical. Let's look at some of these bulletins. The first one is probably the most important one here, and we rated it as patch now for the client. MS-12043 patches XML Core Services. Now, XML Core Service, essentially your XML parser that comes with Windows. However, there are a couple of different versions, and those versions don't necessarily replace each other. So started as XML Core Services 3, you may still see that. 4 is somewhat getting deprecated, but it's still around, and it is still being supported with patches. The tricky one is Core Services 5. Now, Core Services 6 is what you currently would have with something like Vista or Windows 7. Core Services 5 came as part of Office 2003. So unless you have Office 2003 installed, Core Services 5 is not a problem with you. The reason I mention that is Core Services 5 has not been patched yet, and that would come as part of an Office patch. Now, Office 2003 is sort of in this extended support period. There will still be security patches for Office 2003. That's what this extended support period means, but it's no longer really considered a current and actively supported software. So that may be one reason why the patch for Core Services 5 is a little bit late at coming along here. So be careful still with these different XML documents. And of course, Office does heavily rely on XML. Then we got MS-12044. We rated that critical on the client just like Microsoft. It fixes two different vulnerabilities. And this is just your normal Internet Explorer rollout patch, so it does include prior patches as well. Definitely, you do want to patch that pretty quickly because, well, exploits are going to come out for that reasonably soon. Before the webcast earlier this morning, I checked and I didn't see any sort of, you know, active exploits being available in packs like Metasploit, other than the XML vulnerability, of course, that I just discussed. That XML vulnerability that was released or made public about a month ago, just around the time of the last patch Tuesday, and that has since then been actively exploited. So the XML one, that's why it's red hot and patched now, that you want to patch very quickly. Next, MS-12045, that's ActiveX data objects. We had plenty of patches for that in the past. It's essentially an ActiveX library that allows you to access data in various forms. What Microsoft did here is actually a pretty nice and good thing. They came up with this ActiveX data objects, or ADO, which is part of what Microsoft calls Microsoft Data Access Components, or MDAC. Now, what this really does for a developer is a developer can write code and read data, not really being too concerned about how the data is stored. So whether it's stored in text files, whether it's stored in a SQL database, via ODBC and such, to the developer, that's all the same. And that's a good thing. That makes it easier to develop. But historically, the libraries, these ADO libraries, had a couple of different bugs. And of course, because ActiveX is quite frequently used in attacks and your browser is exposed to it, and that makes this a big and important, or critical in this case, vulnerability. Next, MS-12046, Visual Basic for Applications. The basic vulnerability here is actually quite old. August 2010 is when it was originally patched and mentioned. The problem with this vulnerability is it affects many, many different software packages. The basic vulnerability here is that if you start vulnerable software and a DLL that it tries to load is not available in any of the default locations, it will look in your current directory. Now, the current directory that you are located in as you start a software may be a directory that is controlled by the attacker. The two options I always pointed out here are WebDAV and SMB as remote file shares that are being possibly used in this case. So an attacker essentially would, for example, tell you, hey, I got this file here on this WebDAV server. Why don't you open it? You go to that WebDAV server, you open the file. In the same directory, there is a malicious DLL. The normal software opening the file can't find that DLL. It finds it in the malicious directory and then loads it. Now, you would think that if it doesn't find the DLL at all. Like most of the time, it wouldn't find it at all because you don't have that DLL. The software wouldn't crash, and that's not necessarily true. If features that are offered by that DLL are not used, the software may still run in certain circumstances. Now, Microsoft made available tools for developers to find and scan for that problem. And it's kind of odd that it took Microsoft that long to find this problem, essentially 2 years, to find and fix this problem in Visual Basic for applications. The other kind of tricky part here is that the affected library, it's actually DLL that includes other DLLs that's being affected here, VBE6.dll, it may be included by applications that you download from others. So even if you don't have Visual Basic for applications installed, someone may sort of package an application, ship it to you, and include that library. And that's legal, that's not malicious, that's normal. They just include the libraries that you need to run their applications. Well, now you have to find all these old instances of VBE6.dll because Microsoft, of course, only patches the one that ships with Windows by default. There are a couple of workarounds here that you should have already applied 2 years ago when this first was mentioned that will essentially just prevent DLLs from being loaded from network drives. That at least will eliminate the attack scenario where someone directs you to a network drive. Next, MS-12047, kernel mode drivers. Again, that's an old favorite. We do have that pretty much every month. These kernel mode drivers do have to run well as the kernel. If there's a vulnerability in these drivers, they can be used for local privilege escalation. So someone first needs to be a user on the system, then they can use these drivers or the bugs in these drivers to become an administrator without authentication. So this is why it is only really important, because yes, it's an arbitrary code execution, but the only thing you can do with it is local privilege escalation. In this particular case, again, it patches up the keyboard layout issues. We have seen that before as well. And the library or these kernel mode drivers, you find them in win32k.sys. So that's the file that you would see changed. Next one is tricky, and I tried to find more details about that, but so far wasn't really successful. Essentially, the description from Microsoft states that if someone is sending you a file with a badly formed file name, that can lead to arbitrary code execution. The code that's being executed is not depending on the file content, it's depending on the file name. So that's the tricky part here. Like I said, not a lot of details. I tried to find some proof of concept exploit. Luckily, it's not out there yet, but that could become an issue because you could essentially receive a file via email, or maybe you download it from a website. It will pass sort of all the content-based checks, but the file name is actually what triggers the issues here. So we label that critical, unlike Microsoft. Microsoft doesn't label things critical if they actually require you to download something and click on it. In our opinion, that's not really a big kind of hurdle if there's no real warning or so that this potentially will execute a code. Next, MS-12049, this fixes these chain block ciphers that you use in TLS. Now, the fix sounds very much like the Beast vulnerability. If you remember, the Beast vulnerability came out November last year, and essentially what it involves is that with these chain block ciphers, the key being used for the next block of data that's being encrypted depends on the prior block. Essentially, it uses the encrypted version of the block before as key for the next block. And what the Beast attack did was it injected a lot of plain text or known plain text into the connection, which then made it easier to derive these keys for an attacker. Now, that vulnerability has been fixed in MS-12.6. The description here doesn't really say what's different about this fix. but I assume there was some additional weakness or so they found where the original fix didn't necessarily work. Actually, I don't quite agree. We had some discussions here. I don't quite agree with labeling that critical for us. I think it's really more an important one. The exploit is somewhat theoretical at this point. Yes, it has been demonstrated, and there is a working exploit for it, but it has a lot of dependencies, and I haven't really seen yet any sort of real life outside of the lab exploit of this vulnerability. And meaning here the beast vulnerability, so the vulnerability that was hopefully fixed with MS-1206. Sorry. My mouse went a little bit amok here. Next one is MS-12050 SharePoint. Now, we keep seeing those vulnerabilities to essentially SharePoint is a web application, and it's potentially vulnerable to all the different web application vulnerabilities, like in this case, cross-site scripting. Now, this doesn't just affect SharePoint by itself, but also various components, InfoPath, a Groove Server. If you have any of that installed, yes, you have to apply this patch. Doesn't apply, of course, to the client. Now, in our definition, again, client means a system that's not running any services, so workstation. Servers, of course, that's important. That could be used to privilege escalation, where someone is injecting cross-site scripting into a page, waits for an other user to come along, and then with this cross-site scripting attack, you could trigger various things in the user's browsers, like the usual legal cookies, cross-site request forging, and all your standard web application vulnerabilities would apply here. This should be pretty trivial to exploit once there are more details available. Again, I haven't really seen any sort of current exploits for this one yet. And then finally, we got a patch for Office for the Mac. So this only applies to you if you're running Office on OS 10, does not apply to the Windows version of Office. And what this fixes is permissions of files. Now, like on any systems, you don't want any user to be able to, for example, add files to a directory when you have applications installed. You want to limit that to the administrator, and that's essentially the problem they have here. You'll be able to replace some of the Office files, add additional files as a regular user. So that's, again, a privilege escalation vulnerability, not an arbitrary code execution vulnerability in that sense. The patch was this time released at the same time as all of the Windows patches. In the past, sometimes Microsoft sort of had a not-so-regular patch schedule for the Mac software, but lately they have stuck to the same schedule as for their Windows software. So just the patch order quickly here. The number one, of course, should be the MS-12043. That's the XML Core services that's already being exploited out there. And then the Visual Basic one, just because, and I would say Visual Basic and the Internet Explorer, they're very similar in ranking, just because there's so many Explorer vulnerabilities out there. It's a big target. It's not that hard probably to exploit that. Same for the Visual Basic vulnerability, it's pretty straightforward to exploit. So those I would treat next. ActiveX data objects, of course, again, something that allows arbitrary code execution and is available via a web browser is certainly something that you do want to cover here. Windows Shell, kernel drivers, these are privilege escalation vulnerabilities, so that's why I ranked them somewhat lower. And the TLS one last, because I don't really expect any sort of widespread exploit for that anytime soon, and it's fairly limited in its scope in particular since the MS-12006 patch already fixed most of that problem. Now, for servers, of course, we have the SharePoint one. If you run SharePoint, you want to apply that. And for the Macs, yes, you have the Office for the Mac vulnerability. That would be your only patch to apply out of that set if you are running a Mac. So these were the normal patches that were released by Microsoft last Tuesday. However, we had, in addition to these patches, we also had two security advisories that weren't labeled a patch. First one, this was a fix-it to disable gadgets. Now, gadgets came out in Windows Vista. If you remember, it was actually sort of one of the big UI improvements that was advertised in Vista, that you had these little, I guess you would call it apps these days, applets that can run on your desktop and provide sort of, you know, simple background functionality like clock, world time zones, things like weather maps and such that sort of continuously will update in your desktop. Most of them are just simple HTML snippets that you sort of include, but they can be full-fledged applications. Now, the problem here is that they don't run in any kind of sandbox or so. So if you download a malicious application or if you download a vulnerable application, a lot of them, you know, access like the weather maps, they download data from various websites, then you're potentially exposing that user's account. A lot of system administrators felt not very comfortable with this, you know, being able for the user being able to sort of install these applications. So what Microsoft did with this fix-it essentially just gave you the option to turn off that feature. So it's not a bug fix per se, unless you call gadgets a bug. But it just makes it easy for you to disable them. Whether or not you disable them is really a policy matter more than anything else. You know, how much do you trust the users not to install these malicious gadgets they may find around? And you know, do you need them for anything sort of business critical? That's sort of the decisions or the issues you have to look at. Now, in Windows 8, these gadgets will go away. There's some indication that this is all sort of part of a move to, you know, go more into like an app store concept or something like that, you know, that Apple does. Maybe offer something that's a little bit more sandbox, so an application that you download as a gadget doesn't have access to the full system, but only to the files it actually needs to have access to. And the next one is, well, a continuation of an old saga of bad certificate authorities. Now, these are not applied as a patch. However, Windows will continuously check for updated lists of discontinued certificates. This is not what's sometimes called a certificate revocation list. Certificate revocation lists are offered by different certificate authorities, and if your browser is configured to do so, it will once a day, once an hour, depends, update these lists. This one is a Microsoft operating system feature where certain certificate authorities may be placed on an untrusted list. So this is a step above the certificate revocation list. According to Microsoft, the certificates it added to this list with the security advisory are not stolen. However, Microsoft found out that they were not stored secure enough and not stored in accordance to Microsoft's own policy. So as a result, Microsoft said, well, you know, before anything goes wrong, and maybe they have been stolen, but we just haven't found out yet. So Microsoft put these certificate authorities on the trusted list. These are intermediate certificate authorities, so they themselves are signed using Microsoft's top-level certificate authorities, and these certificates could be used, if they got stolen, to actually sign other people's software. So, you know, that's just what we saw with the Flame exploit, for example. That's how these certificate authority certificates could be abused. Microsoft actually also released a list of all the companies that own legitimate certificates to, for example, sign drivers. And that list was pretty long. I think it was something like 28,000, or it was a huge list of entities that do have access essentially to this kind of capability, where Microsoft gave them a certificate authority that signed with Microsoft's certificate authority that then can be used by these companies to, for example, sign device drivers. And if you remember, that's sort of what happened with Stuxnet as part of the exploit where a certificate authority was stolen from a driver manufacturer, then used to sign some drivers that were part of Stuxnet. So again, those large tools, they're not really bug fixes, not really patches. The certificate authority untrusted update, you should have received apart from the normal patch cycle. So your operating system periodically changed with Microsoft for new certificate authorities to put on the untrusted list. Anyway, so much about Microsoft patches. A special topic this month, I figured we should talk a little bit about packet capture manipulation. Essentially, you have a packet capture and you would like to change the content of the packet capture. And it's something I do quite frequently for a number of reasons, and I'll get to that in a second. But here's sort of a list of tools I'll discuss here. TCP rewrite and EditCap are probably the easiest and sort of most generic tools to do that with. Scapy, if you want full control over packets. And then some very specific tasks, like merge cap to actually merge packets. Now, I mentioned a couple other tools here. I'll show you pack ETH, I guess you would pronounce the tool. That's sort of a GUI to do it with. The other tools are command line tools, and then VI, which is not necessarily a packet tool, but can be used to manipulate payloads in some cases. Text-to-PCAP, I just mentioned here as an additional example. Text-to-PCAP takes the text output that you get out of TCP dump, if you dump it to the screen, and converts it back into a packet capture file. So anyway, why would you do this? Well, essentially you want to modify packets that you captured. This is different from crafting packets. And if you use a tool like Scapy, for example, to craft a packet, you start out from scratch. But in this case, we already have a packet capture. Like in the introduction, I mentioned these odd scans we saw earlier today. You, for example, have a capture like this, and you want to see what it is doing against your devices. So you may have to change target IP address. You may want to change, hey, what if the attacker changes certain fields? Does that change the outcome? So that's where you would use that. Same to test your IDS. Again, you have an exploit. You wrote a signature for it. But now you want to test various evasion techniques, for example. Now that's, again, where this comes in handy. Anonymizing packets, that's where I use it quite a bit. You have a packet capture, you don't want to give away the IP addresses and such, so you want to modify the packet capture. And then you just, for if you're using it, for example, in the class, or you just want to see what happens, you're playing with packets, using it like packet crafting, but you have already something to start out with. So, first of all, what you start out with is a libpcap file. Let's talk a little bit about libpcap files and how they look. A libpcap file starts with a global header. There's sort of this magic number it starts out with, A1, B1, C3, D4. This is written in the byte order of the system, so you may see D4, C3, B2, A1, or B2, A1, D4, C3. That's also used then essentially to figure out how is the rest of the file encoded. And then you have our version numbers, a major and a minor version. Currently, that would be 2.4. And that's the file format version, not the libpcap version necessarily. The time zone correction in seconds. So that's where tcpdump and Wireshark and those tools get the timestamp from, essentially, is the time zone, and then the actual timestamp that's associated with each packet. A timestamp accuracy, now that's usually set to 0, but it's meant to indicate how accurate is the timestamp. The snap length, so it tells a little bit about how the data was captured, and then the network type. You know, there are various network types that you could have, like PPP links or 802.11. One, the most common one, would be just the Ethernet. And then again, it helps tcpdump to interpret the data. So that basically, if it's one, it would tell tcpdump that the packets all start with an Ethernet header. Then each individual record has its own packet header, and then the packet data. The packet header includes the timestamp in seconds, and then also the microseconds part of this timestamp. Then how much data was captured for this particular packet, which would be your snap link. And then the original length, so how long was this packet before the snap length was applied to it. So that way, for example, tcdump knows that you didn't get the full packet. Now, this is the current libpcap format. There's also a pcap-ng under development. They're essentially trying to, those kind of main fixes, I guess, for libpcap ng is to allow for more metadata to be stored with the packet capture. Bioshark does implement pcap ng as of version 1.2 and tshark as of version 1.6. It's really an extension to the pcap format. It now breaks down your data into blocks. Again, you're allowing for more metadata, and then if you have multiple packet captures and you merge them, each one sort of could have its own header, for example. You can add, for example, as one of these blocks, name resolution. So if you ran a tcdump with name resolution, now the host names are stored with the packet capture. That's helpful if the name resolution changed, for example, over time. Now, you look at the packet cache from yesterday, in particular, if you're looking at, for example, malicious domains, they tend to change quite frequently, and here there's an option to actually store that information with the packet capture. Also, for example, which interface the data was recorded at. If you have multiple interfaces on the system, things like the IP address of that interface, all of that is stored with it. You can also now add comments, for example, in Bioshark that are then being stored with the packet capture. So lots and lots of additional information. You can have blocks with statistics, so you don't have to read the entire packet capture or parse it if you're just interested in some generic statistics, for example, dropped packets. So it's a more flexible file format. But I would recommend not to use it at this point. It's not finalized yet. Like I said, Bioshark implements it, and Bioshark is sort of driving a little bit that file format. But there may be changes to it in the future. And for example, some of these blocks are not yet defined in what they exactly will look like. So let's walk through a couple of example scenarios where you may want to modify packet captures. So how do we change an address? How do we fix checksums? Changing the timestamp? Remove the payload or change the payload? And I wanted to show you sort of the GUI solution to all of this. So first of all, change the address. The tool for this is TCP rewrite. Now, if you're looking for the tool, you may have to look for TCP replay. TCP replay is really a suite of tools, and TCP replay itself would allow you, for example, to send the packet after you modified it back to the network. And one thing that TCP rewrite offers, and one reason I use it a lot, is to just rewrite the addresses. So the way you specify this here is they call it pseudonet or pnet, and you basically specify the original net block and then colon and what you would like to replace it with. So in this case, I connected to Yahoo, I believe, that Yahoo's net block, and I want to obfuscate that for just the example net block, 192.0.2. This will work for the source and destination IP address, but you can limit it to the source and destination IP address. And there are a number of different things that you can rewrite with TCP rewrite. You can change TTLs, you can change the type of service, the checksum is fixed automatically. If you have a file with a broken checksum, then TCP rewrite is the tool to fix it for you. TCP rewrite works for IPv6 just like it works for IPv4. So it does support both protocols. So to fix the checksum with TCP rewrite, we just use the capital C option. And that will fix your IP, UDP, TCP, ICMP checksum. Of course, for IPv6, there wouldn't be an IP checksum, and it just fixes the higher level checksums. For part of the operations, like I just mentioned with PNAT, that fix is done automatically. However, if you, for example, use another tool to modify, for example, the payload, then this comes in handy to just fix the checksums of a packet capture. By the way, I highly recommend that you do fix your checksums if you do change addresses, because you have 2 bytes of checksum. If you only change 2 bytes of the address, then the checksum could still be used to reconstruct the original address. On Ethernet checksums, it can't fix them. However, there is an option to remove them, and most Ethernet doesn't have checksums anyway. So again, you can just remove the Ethernet checksums. Now, changing the timestamp. Now, this comes in handy is if you're, for example, you capture some exploit traffic, you know what is signature for it, you want to replay it against Lord or whatever, and you want to make sure that it uses a current timestamp. The easiest way I find to do that is EditCap. Again, EditCap can do a couple different things, however, it really focuses on timestamps. It comes as part of the Wireshark command line tools usually, so you may already have it and you don't really have to install it yourself by hand. It can also be used to filter by timestamps. You can tell EditCap, I want to get all packets within a certain time window. That's another useful feature of EditCap. To change the timestamp, just -t and then the number of seconds. If you want to go back in the past, you just use minus and the number of seconds. And then the original and the final file name. So in this case, we would read the packets from now.pcap and then change all the timestamps by adding 3,600 seconds to it and then save the result to future pcap. It can also be used to anonymize data if you basically don't want to give away what time you saw a certain exploit. Now, when we're talking about anonymizing data, it's of course a problem. You can change the IP addresses, but fundamentally, a lot of the IP addresses also show up in payload. So, and payload, of course, also contains sometimes confidential information that you do want to remove. Removing payload is a little bit tricky because it's not that obvious if you think about it, what is the payload? It really depends on what layer of the protocols do you think at. For example, for Ethernet, IP is the payload. For IP, your TCP and UDP header is the payload. For TCP, well, your HTTP payload would be payload, but for HTTP, the HTTP headers are not payload. It's just the content of the page, the body of the request or the response that's considered payload as far as HTTP is concerned. So you have to make up your mind, what do you consider payload? I played with a number of tools over time to do this, and I found that Scapy is the best tool to remove payloads and to do that most flexible. Essentially, it does allow for the flexibility to basically decide yourself, what do you call a payload? Now, once you remove the payload, checksums, of course, become meaningless because you can no longer calculate them without the payload. So you may as well set them to zero. Also, length fields may be wrong if you do that. So that's another sort of thing to look for. If you then, for example, try to run this against an IDS, not that this necessarily makes a lot of sense because you no longer have any payloads or trigger signatures on, but you definitely have to turn off your checksums if you do that. And most of the time what I find, I think if you try to check a simple IDS signature that just looks at headers, most of the time your IP preprocessors and such are sort of barking at the packet because the length fields are wrong now. This escapee script I usually use to remove payloads. So at first I read the packet capture and escapee has this rdpcap function. To read it, I just call it intro.pcap here. Then I iterate through it, and that's sort of the weird Python thing where you have to indent and make sure that you do that correctly. So I iterate through all the packets that I just read. And then based on the sort of protocol layer I find, I do remove the payload. So if this is a TCP packet, then I remove the TCP payload. If it's an ICMP packet, I do remove the ICMP payload, and so on. But you will, for example, also destroy the ICMP type and code. And then if it, it's UDP, again, I am destroying the UDP payload. Actually, sorry, it will not display the ICMP type and code, but you know, whatever additional fields you may have, like your sequence number, may be considered payload here for ICMP echo requests and replies. Now, how do we change the payload? That really depends on what you're trying to accomplish. SCAPI can do it. If SCAPI understands the payload protocol, then this actually works pretty well. You can actually do it with snort inline. Snort inline allows you to replace strings, but then you have to send it into snort. You could do it with a read. I've never really tried to read packets with snort inline. I'm not really sure that will work because you have to send them to that queue first in IP tables. So, but theoretically, use TCP replay, send it against snort, and then write a snort to replace it, and then capture it again on the output end with TCP dump. What I actually find works pretty well is just a hex editor or VI. If you're doing this, you then you just launch VI, use the dash B switch, and then you have to enter this colon percent exclamation mark XXD. Isn't VI fun? And actually, let me just do a quick demo of this. Let me see. I think I have a packet capture. I have something here. Yeah, it doesn't really matter what the packet capture is. So if I'm loading it with VI, I get this gobbledygook. Yeah. And if it's just, for example, the host header I want to manipulate, I just go in there and change it. But if I now do colon percent exclamation mark XXD, now I get it in this hex format. So now you may be able, for example, to pick out an header here, like an Ethernet header maybe, or where's my 4.5? I'm looking for my 4.5 here. That's the IP header. And I could try to manipulate that and then change it. It's a pain, yeah? But it can work. Yeah? And then to undo it again, colon percent exclamation mark XXV dash R. I've run into a couple versions of VI that will do it automatically for you if you're loading it with dash B. If you're doing it with dash B, it will automatically then do the conversion for you. And then you just save it. I don't want to save it here. I'm just exiting it. Oh, actually, I forgot to share the screen here. But you'll see it in the recording. If let me just do it quickly here. You do this. OK, now you can see it. The I-B colon percent exclamation mark XXV. That will convert it into the hex format. I can change the hex around now. Once I'm done, I'm doing colon percent exclamation mark XXV dash R to undo it again, and then I save it. Okay. So anyway, so hard to do it, but it can work. Where this comes in handy, and I've done that at times, is you wrote a signature for your IDS for a specific exploit. Now you want to make sure, does it work for normal packets that don't have the particular exploit string? So you go in, you change a couple of characters in that exploit string, you save it, and then you run your it against your IDS again. Make sure that you actually look for the right stuff, you know, that that string that you're looking for doesn't show up somewhere else in the packet and is really just benign. And then, of course, if you do that, you definitely have to fix the checksums, and that's they use TCP rewrite again. So is there any GUI solutions for that? Well, NetDude was of the historic, the old solution for it. It no longer is really supported, actually not for a long time. You can still find it in some distributions, like if you have Packetrix, for example, the distribution we use in Stack 503. I believe it's still in there in some versions. A newer package, so that's essentially the same thing, is PackETH. And let me just show you here a screenshot of what it looks like. This is PackETH. You can start with your link layer header here. You have different options for your Ethernet header. You can do 802.1Q here, for example. Then you set the Ether type. Regardless of the Ether type, you then can pick what's your next layer. It offers IPv4 and IPv6 support. Here you have the IPv6 header. Again, you know, very easy to fill in specific fields that you would like to set. And then you can set the next layer, UDP, TCP, ICMP. That doesn't fit on the slide anymore. That slide is kind of, this font is small enough as is. So then you get below this the options to set your UDP, TCP, ICMP fields. Now, it doesn't have explicit support for application layer protocols. It does actually RDP. That's the one protocol it does. So if you set UDP, you have an option then, instead of just a generic UDP packet, to set RDP headers. If you, for any other application layer protocol, you sort of have to manually then provide a payload. You can enter just an arbitrary payload for the TCP or UDP packet. Up here then, it allows you to send the packets or send multiple packets. You can sort of set the speed at which you send them, or you can just save a packet capture. You can also load a packet capture, and it has various options, for example, to load different IP address lists and such. So it's not bad. It's a little bit clumsy at times, the interface, but if you don't want to use any of the other tools, if Scapey is a little bit too obscure for you, then certainly that's one option for you to use. So anyway, this is what I have today. If you have any questions, handlers@sans.edu. I'll stick a little bit around if anybody here has any questions they want to answer, ask now. Use the chat window if you have any questions. The email address to reach the internet storms is just isc.sans.edu. If you would like to submit any data, the howto.html. Also, we do have a contact form. Just go to the contact link on the isc.sans.edu page. The contact form is preferred if you want to send us any attachments. Attachments frequently get stripped by email servers. With the contact form, it has a feature that allows you to upload files like packet captures, malware, whatever, to us. Any questions? Don't see any questions. Again, an archive will be made available shortly via sans.org/webcast. Find the archive link. We'll also publish this as an audio podcast, and hopefully, if this works, like I said, that's the first time we'll try that as a video podcast. Thanks for listening, and talk to you again in August. Bye.